Martin Fletcher has been reporting on conflicts around the world for over 30 years. After many years as NBC's Tel Aviv bureau chief, he took a vacation during which he walked the entire coast of Israel. He visited our show last month to discuss his account of the experience, a book called Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation, and we thought that we would re-air it for you today. I started off by asking Martin Fletcher, why did you decide to walk the entire Mediterranean coast of Israel? Might you have been just as likely to have chosen a walk on its inland border?
Well, that's exactly what the choice was. How to walk through Israel? Because I wanted to look at Israel from a different point of view, and the coast of Israel offers a completely different view of Israel than the Israel we normally see and that I've been reporting on for so many years. So that's what I want to do, something different. And the coast was a wonderful opportunity to see the country through new eyes.
Also, isn't the coast fairly short? So how long is it?
There is that. Well, it's only 110 miles. I mean, it's amazing. It's like the length of Long Island is the coast of Israel.
So this is like walking from Manhattan to the Hamptons.
Well, yeah, I guess you...
It took you 2 weeks.
It took me 2 weeks, and I did a year's research afterwards on you know, issues and people that I came across.
Now, when we say it took you 2 weeks, you were walking at not a brisk pace, and you were stopping a lot.
I was stopping a lot. It was heavy sand. It was very, very hot. But, you know, it's only 110 miles, but one reason I wanted to do it was it has to be the most interesting 100 miles in the world, bar none.
Well, I would have thought that if you'd walked the inland border, you would have seen a lot more that would be of interest to a reporter.
That's exactly true, and that's exactly why I didn't want to do it.
I see.
Because that's how I spent the last 3.5 decades, looking at Israel from the Green Line east, which is where the occupation is, the soldiers, the fighting. I want to look at a different side of Israel.
The side of Israel that faces the Mediterranean.
Well, 70% of Israelis live in that coastal plain. And we don't, you know, I've hardly reported on them in all these years unless there was a bomb or a war.
Hadn't you been putting off taking a vacation for quite a while?
Well, I don't have many vacations, I must say. But you know what? Living in Israel along the coast is pretty much a vacation. I mean, it's a wonderful place to be.
Well, what was happening in 2008 that made you want to finally take this trip?
I guess I reached a certain age. You know, I'd had this idea for a long time, and I really thought that we do a disservice to the country by only focusing on the conflict. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to show that there's another part of the country there. And, you know, people always ask me, hey, is it safe to visit Israel? And I'd say, yeah, of course. Then a week later, they'd call me up and say, wow, it's a great place. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write a book about that great place about which people have no idea.
Although conflict often comes up in conversation with them, it's almost impossible to escape it, isn't it?
That's what I try to do. But you know what? You can't escape the conflict, and you shouldn't escape the conflict, because I didn't downplay the problems Israel has and the urgency needed to solve those problems. I just wanted to point out, hey, guess what? There's another country here beyond the one that is only in permanent conflict with the Palestinians.
What brought you to Israel in the first place? Was it seen as a plum job?
With NBC, I guess it was, and I was able to hang on to that plum job for a quarter of a century. So, yeah, it was, for me, it was a fascinating place, and it was where I wanted to be. It's a story very, very close to my heart, and I am passionate about it, and I have been for a long time. One reason I wanted to show that there is another side to it.
Well, when you arrived, you had no idea you were going to stay so long.
That's true. No.
Then you got married.
Well, the first time I went to Israel was actually in 1973. Mm-hmm. And I met my wife in 1974. She was a soldier. She was hitchhiking, and I gave her a ride. And we're still together. Maybe she's even listening to this program. I'm sure she is.
Why do you think this part of the country is so overlooked? Is it because it's less likely to be in conflict?
Well,
is that what Israel is totally, as far as people from on the outside are concerned, a place where there's constant conflict?
I think it is seen in that way, and that's what I wanted to show is not the whole truth. It's a very important part of the truth, obviously, and you can't escape the conflict. I mean, even though I say that 70% of Israelis live in the coastal plain, nevertheless, every single family there has one or two people in the army. So it's not that they're away from the conflict. It's just that there's another wonderful lifestyle with great technological achievements and all kinds of other issues, also very problematic issues, but different issues. You know, we focus always on the conflict because that's what a story is in the Western world, isn't it? You see it through, as your previous speaker mentioned, it's a book is a journey. Mm-hmm. And if it isn't a journey, then it's unlikely to be a good book. And in Israel, it's conflict. And conflict is the way we see the world.
Did you go with anyone?
I began walking by myself.
You had wanted your son to go with
you. I wanted my son to go with me. I had this idea for a long time of walking down the coast of Israel with my son. And the title I was going to call the book was The Father, the Son, and the Holy Coast.
Oh.
But the publisher thought that may turn off too many people. But I thought it was a good title. But in fact, we ended up with a rather more mundane Walking Israel.
And your son decided not to go with you.
And anyway, my son didn't want to come, so yeah.
Did you plan who you were going to talk to along the way before you started?
No, I had no plans at all. I left it completely free.
And were people generally open to talking to you?
Well, I think they may have been open, except being English, I can't actually meet people unless I'm introduced to them first. So right away, the basic flaw in my premise of meeting people was that I'm lousy at meeting people. So it took me a few days to pluck up courage, and then I just met people along the way. And the issues that were raised, I found, I think were essentially the true issues of the country.
David Grossman, who's a wonderful Israeli writer, both of fiction and nonfiction, told me once that when he talks to his Arab friends, they speak in English because although they speak Hebrew and he speaks Arabic, one side would have an advantage, so English is the one that equalizes everything. Can you get along speaking in English in Israel?
You can get along speaking in English in Israel when you speak to a certain level of people, if you like, educational level. And, walking down the coast, it was important to me to get away from the spokesmen, the writers, the people I normally speak to.
So what language were you speaking in?
English. Hebrew, I speak Hebrew, or something, a tiny bit of Arabic. But mostly in English. It's just that the kind of people you would meet in my daily work as a reporter are not the people I was meeting as I walked down the coast of Israel. Yet the issues I came across covered all the gamut of Israel, of course, but seen from a completely new perspective.
When you're walking along the coast, did most of the Arab Israelis you meet speak in Hebrew?
They're perfectly willing to speak in Hebrew. They don't have a problem with that. I mean, in David Grossman's case, maybe that was the issue. But in general, that's their language.
Well, he's usually talking about people in across the border or whatever. He's not talking about the people who you were meeting here.
Yeah. No, but, in all my time there, I've obviously spent so many hundreds of times to Gaza and the West Bank, if not thousands. I've always found people, if they speak English, are entirely willing to speak English to me, but they always say, "Do you speak Arabic?" first.
My guest is Martin Fletcher, whose latest book is called Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. It's published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You had a backpack, so you were limited as to what you could carry, but you carried two books with you. Why?
Because the journey I was taking was such an interesting, as I said earlier, it has to be the most interesting 100 miles in the world when you consider what happened, Alexander the Great, the events of the Bible, the Crusaders, Napoleon, modern Israel, the British. So there's so much has happened there. I wanted to read about other people who'd made the same journey, especially the Crusaders and the troops of Napoleon, who actually walked exactly the road that I took, or rather the beach that I took.
So you read something by Napoleon and a history of the Crusaders?
By different knights of the Crusades who wrote their personal accounts. Absolutely fascinating stuff.
Anything that you could connect to, that you could relate to? Or I'm sure the country's changed an awful lot in the intervening years.
Well, some things never change, I guess. So the bishop of Akko in the 13th century complained bitterly about all the prostitution and the brothels and the Crusader knights misspending their time. And he said even the monks in Akko were renting out their homes to prostitutes because they earned more money that way. And he was complaining. This was in the 13th century, so something's never changed.
Although that's happening now?
No, it's not. as far as I know.
You write that part of your purpose for taking this trip was to delve deeper into the hearts of Israelis. We're talking about a rather diverse population, aren't we? Is there one kind of heart of an Israeli?
Of course there isn't, but each person has his own story, which doesn't get told when you're a reporter for the news. We concentrate, as I said, on conflict, on the big stories. I wanted to show what it's really like. I'll give you an example. A soldier, a young boy going into the army, we can all identify with an 18-year-old boy who's now faced with serving 3 years in the army. Some love it, some hate it. Almost all of them do it. I met one boy who I would never have met before, who had spent 18 months in the army as a medic, and he'd had a rather hard time in Gaza. And after 18 months, he decided that he wanted to get out of the army. How do you do that? He lied his way out of the army. He went to see the psychologist. He saw a psychiatrist. He saw a committee of social workers over a period of about a month. And I was with him I spoke to him after each of those meetings in which he'd lied his way out of the army. I thought, this guy's going to end up in jail. In fact, in the end, he got out. So that's something very interesting to hear his motivation, what he thought about it. And funnily enough, when the psychiatrist in his very last meeting invited him into the room, he had one question for him. Do you want to leave the army? And he said, yes. So he said, leave the room. And then he called the soldier's mother and said, is it okay if your son leaves the army? So the mother gave permission in the end.
So the psychiatrist thought, well, why keep him if he doesn't want to be here? Because he must have known that the kid was lying to get out.
Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But plenty of young boys try to get out of the army. In fact, 15% of Israeli males soldiers leave the army before the end of 3 years.
So there's no stigma attached to that?
There's less stigma than in the past. But this particular boy, for instance, said that his girlfriend was devastated when he told her. So there is stigma, yeah.
You mentioned Acre. That's a city that you like a lot. Now, I'm not sure I've ever heard of Acre.
Oh, Acre. It's
Acre. A-K-K-O in
Hebrew. Acre in English. A-C-R-E.
Oh, okay.
It's a wonderful town in the north. Beautiful place.
I've only known it as Acre. I guess this is one of those things that happens again and again. If I went to Ceylon and everybody was saying Sri Lanka, I wouldn't have known what I was doing.
That's right.
One of the places that you visit is Achzivland. What is Achzivland?
Well, Achziv is a community right in the north of Israel with a bizarre personality who lives there called Eli Avivi, who colonized a place in the early 50s and created his own little independent state of Achzivland, he called it. And it became a sort of hippie beatnik center for Israelis where they would naked bathing on the beach and drugs. And it was sort of an alternative center. But he's still there. This guy's still there. And
has it changed a lot over the past 55 years?
Well, the place has. I mean, Club Med, for instance, took part of that land and built a Club Med there. And they advertised it at the time. I read one of their early brochures saying, recommending its authentic Arabian atmosphere. I don't think it occurred to anybody that the reason it was so authentic was it was a destroyed and taken over Arab village, of course. Mm.
But the person who was living there, Eli Avivi, was not an Arab.
No, of course not. He was an Israeli Jew who took over the land. And
did the hippies still meet there?
People still go there for the weekend. Not so much hippies. It's changed, but the demographics changed. But I said to him, do the Arabs who used to live in this village ever come? Because now they charge 20 shekels to get into the little area. And he said, yes. I said, well, that must be awful. Paying 20 shekels, $7 to visit your old stolen home. He said, no, when the Arabs come, they only pay half price.
in the city of, I'm going to say Acre, I don't know, you met Sami and Hussam. Tell us about them.
Well, this guy, Eli Avivi, took over their land. And it was their land. They were from that village. And so I wanted to find people from the village and find out what they thought about the Israeli who was living in their land. Because obviously, the story you expect to hear is, it's our land, we want it back, we'll fight till we get it. These guys told a completely different story. It turned out that one of them had been a colonel in the Israeli army. He'd become Jewish. And when I asked him, why did you become a Jew? I spent a month trying to get the story out of him. He never told me why. But the story that I found was absolutely fascinating, and I followed it for a month.
Now, I just saw a film a couple of months ago about a woman who goes to somewhere in Israel to reclaim the family home and the money that her grandfather left in a bank, and she's outraged that she can't get any of that stuff back. Is that the outsider's view of what goes on?
I'm not sure of the film. This was an Arab woman or a Jewish woman?
She's an Arab woman.
Yeah. Look, no, I mean, it's an absolutely realistic.
There are people like Sami and Hussam who might be very angry that that this land was confiscated all those years back and feel that they still should have it returned.
Absolutely. This man that I met, these two guys that I met, Sami and Hussam, I mean, they were complete exceptions. I mean, this is almost a freakish exception. And that's why I was so surprised. And that's one reason I wanted to follow their story. Later on, I met other members of the same family, and who all, of course, you know, said that we that's our land and we want it back. One day we'll get it back.
But it's my sense that in Accra, Jews and Arabs get along quite well. Has something happened in this area that's different from other parts of the country?
That's one of the questions I tried to follow when I was there, to find out why it is that the Jews and Arabs do get on well in Accra. They also get on pretty well in Haifa. But, you know, it's a very superficial harmony. But nevertheless, harmony is better than fighting. And I personally see Accra as an example of the way things could be in the future. It is possible for Jews and Arabs to live together, and Accra shows it.
Is that because the city government has done things to encourage that?
Well, one thing that one of the guys I met there, Abdu, an Arab, said to me, he said, "We're happy that there's more Jews here than Arabs." He said, "That way we know we'll get a good city budget." So he was very practical about it.
You met several Arab Israelis on your trip. What role do they play in Arab society? I mean, in Israeli society. Well, how integrated are they?
Well, they're pretty integrated, but of course they are in many ways what they call themselves, second-class citizens in many ways. And yet, again, I didn't want to go down that path in the book because that's what everybody writes about. What I wanted to write about, and with the direction I went into in one chapter anyway, was what's it like for an Israeli-Arab couple who are educated, accepted, have reached the top, and yet don't feel equal. Why not? And that was the direction I took. And a very fascinating. I met a writer and a lawyer, Arabs, whose whole world is on one hand equal in every way with any Israeli, and yet their whole professional world is only with Arabs. The lawyer deals with Israeli Arab problems. The writer writes in Arabic and is upset that his work is not translated into Hebrew.
Well, what happens when people cross over? There was I keep on talking about films. I saw another film about 6 months ago, which was co-directed by an Israeli and an Arab. And one of the key figures is an Arab who has an Israeli girlfriend, a Jewish girlfriend. And that causes trouble for him all down the line.
It's very hard. It's very hard. There are quite a few married relationships and couples of obviously Israeli and Arab. What happens normally is that the Jew, when they marry an Arab, becomes a Muslim. And that way they're quickly accepted by Muslim society. But the other way around doesn't work so well.
Well, there's always that business about who do they feel allegiance to? And isn't that something that Israeli Jews often say, that they can't really trust the Israeli Arabs, even though they've been part of the country for so many years, because in the end they have divided allegiances?
Absolutely, and they're probably right. They do have divided allegiances. They're Israeli citizens, but their blood, if you like, is with the Palestinians across in the West Bank.
So do they experience an identity crisis?
Very much so, very much so, and it's very difficult for them. The people that I was meeting along the way. I mean, I've been there for so many years. I met all kinds of people, as you can imagine. But the most important conclusion I drew from meeting the Israeli Arabs was that however accepted they are, however integrated they feel, and even those who don't have a divided loyalty, nevertheless believe and say, every single one of them, that ultimately Israel will no longer be there. Something will happen. That's the phrase they use. Something will happen. And so the question of divided loyalty is a real issue, and it's not one can gloss over with politics.
But they do choose to remain in Israel.
Absolutely.
Some of these people have enough money and success and education to be able to leave.
Well, many do leave. Many do leave, same as Jews leave, some Arabs leave. But one journalist I wrote to, I met, for instance, said, I asked him a question, how many of your Arab friends would actually move to a Palestinian state in the West Bank if there was one, given how much they hate the Israeli democracy? And he said, if you find one person, he'll be the headline in our paper tomorrow.
My guest is Martin Fletcher, who's written a book called Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with an interview I did in October with Martin Fletcher, who's been the longtime NBC Tel Aviv bureau chief. He was on our show to discuss his book, Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. I asked him whether he was still the bureau chief at NBC.
No, actually, I retired in January. I'm still working with NBC on a freelance basis. reporting, but I actually left because I wanted to write books.
Mm-hmm. Books on these are things that you've been thinking about for a long time and have been unable to talk about because journalism sort of forces you to focus on very specific things.
Yeah, I didn't.
Well, you could have done documentaries, right?
There's lots of things I could have done, but I've always wanted to write books, and I thought, you know, a certain time in my life, you know, do what you want to do.
Jewish Israelis and Arab Israelis are pretty quick to characterize each other. Is part of the problem that everyone thinks they know the other one so well?
Familiarity breeds contempt, does it? I guess in that case it does. It's searching for a way to get along when one group has come and taken over the land of another group, regardless of who's justified or not. There's always an undercurrent of the stronger and the weaker and resentment.
You spoke to several Holocaust survivors. Why were you interested in speaking with them?
Well, again, it's something I discovered along the journey, which I didn't know, which was that Holocaust survivors, when they first arrived in Palestine in 1945, 6 and 7, were not welcomed by most of the Jews in Palestine, which I didn't know.
Spoke a different kind of Hebrew, if they even spoke Hebrew.
Oh, well, they didn't speak Hebrew at all.
But if they did, they spoke Ashkenazic Hebrew, not Sephardic Hebrew.
Yeah, but most of these people were concentration camp survivors who came from Europe, and they spoke, you know, Russian, Polish, German, whatever. And they were seen by the Jews in Palestine at the time, who were trying to reinvent themselves as farmers and fighters and nation builders. They saw these concentration camp survivors as miserable debris from Europe, as weak Jews who had gone like sheep to the slaughter, and they called them nicknames like soap, and they behaved badly to them and didn't want to speak about their problems. So this is very real.
When did that change?
It changed, I found, in 1961 in the Eichmann trial, when suddenly, very suddenly, all of these people with these funny numbers on their arms, the bus driver with the tattoo numbers from Auschwitz and whatnot, who never spoke about their lives and their stories, and they didn't, most of them didn't say a word, suddenly in the Eichmann trial, it all came out. And one of the judges there told me they received 10,000 letters during the Eichmann trial. Half of them were from survivors who said, I want to tell you what happened to me. And the other half were from Israelis who said, I can't believe they didn't fight back. So it was a necessary transition for Israel. And what I found was that Israel's ability now, today, to treat the survivors well sort of mirrors or reflects Israel's growth as a nation, where in the beginning, they felt themselves weak, not able to treat the members of their society that are weak. As Israel matured, now they can embrace the weak, and that's a sign of the growing strength of the society, I found.
So do they treat immigrants differently these days? Of course, we're talking about there are differences between Jewish immigrants and non-Jewish immigrants.
Well, of course, the Holocaust survivors were in a category all of their own. But, for instance, 1 million Russians came to Israel. 1 million Russians, 15% of the population, just in the 90s, and were absorbed very well. Then the Ethiopians came. That was a much tougher absorption. But
race then played a part.
Race played a part. There were also nicknames about them. Just racism like anywhere else. I mean, Jews are no less prone to racism than anybody else. It's, you know, we're all the same. But again, that's also the worst is over because now the Ethiopians have served in the army. They've graduated from high school, they're in universities, and their position is much better than it was. But Ethiopians, when they came, had an unbelievably high suicide rate.
Are people open about these things? Did you find people willing to talk to you? The Holocaust survivors, for example, even in this country, rarely talked about their experiences with their children and grandchildren.
One thing that changed it in Israel, apart from the Eichmann trial, was that students in school around about the age of 7, 8, 9, 10 are given a project which they call Roots. And in those, and they, you know, they all go to interview their family members. And then they spoke to their grandparents. And many grandparents, when they were approached by their grandchild, opened up for the very first time. And one man I profiled, Moshe Rotman, said to me that he had never mentioned his concentration camp experiences, which included Auschwitz, to his wife in 50 years. And when his grandson asked him about it, he spoke for the first time, and his wife couldn't stop crying. And he said to me something amazing. He had been a prisoner of war in Syria, and they were badly treated as Israeli prisoners of war there. And I said to him, well, what was it like being a prisoner of war in Syria? And he said to me, being a prisoner of war in Syria was like a sanatorium after Auschwitz. What a line.
Martin Fletcher's latest book is called Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. It's published by St. Martin's Press. You visited several kibbutzim, the agricultural communes that were so important to the development of Israel at the beginning, part of some socialist vision. Obviously, that's no longer the case.
It's no longer the case by a long way. And what was interesting, again, another angle which I discovered, was one kibbutz along the way, Beit Oren, of Israel's 280 kibbutzim, 180 went bankrupt. The very first one to go bankrupt was Beit Oren. Let me rephrase that. Sorry, 180 didn't go bankrupt. 180 changed from the socialist ethic to a capitalist ethic, excuse me. But many did go bankrupt. And the very first one to go bankrupt was Beit Oren. And I went there, and I met the guy who came up with a plan to save Beit Oren, which, and his plan was then adopted by the kibbutzim and privatized the kibbutzim. But what he did was so revolutionary at the time in Beit Oren that everybody hated him. He left the kibbutz in the end. His marriage broke up. And he said to me, you know, when I left Beit Oren, I didn't know I'd done something wonderful. He said, I felt like, and I won't say the word on radio, but he said, my life was ruined. I didn't realize I'd done something amazing. And then I was hired by another kibbutz. I did the same there. And bit by bit, his work, not only him, he wasn't alone, but he was one of the first ones, revolutionized Israel's kibbutzim. And today they're very strong units again, but very different.
But they played a major role in the development of the country. Why haven't they been able to survive?
Well, because they were lousily managed. And the idea that, for instance, a small kibbutz like Beit Oren, for instance, could have a full-time doctor, two full-time nurses, and constantly updated fresh medicines for a population of about 80 families didn't make any financial sense. And when you apply that logic to all the other things like the kindergarten, the school, the pensions, education on the kibbutz, nothing financially worked. The kibbutzim would rack up great debts. And then because of the labor governments, the labor government would just forgive the debts, because they were from the same stream.
Well, but we haven't had too many labor governments.
Things changed, exactly. And the Likud government said, you know what? You owe us money, pay up.
Are they still considered a desirable place to live in for some people?
Very. And that's what's changed. You see, for a long time, when the kibbutzim went through that transition of going all virtually bankrupt or actually bankrupt, all the young people left. Nobody came back to the kibbutzim. Now that they've been privatized, and now they're making a profit and have changed the quality of life on the kibbutz. Now young people are coming back to the kibbutzim. And, of course, kibbutzim are selling land, which they would never have done before, to outsiders who live inside the kibbutz, but not as kibbutz members. So actually, it's a very desirable alternative way of life, but it's not a kibbutz as it once was.
You're saying outsiders reminds me that a recurring theme throughout the stories you tell in this book is that of the outsider versus the insider. And it's hard to tell sometimes who is who.
Well, I guess that's true probably about most places. But in Israel, maybe that's exaggerated and exaggeratedly true, simply because so many people came so quickly from so many places.
But you lived in Israel for a long time, and yet I get the feeling you're always going to be an outsider.
Oh, yeah. Well, I felt an outsider in England. That's a different question.
So you're just somebody who feels like an outsider wherever you are. But, I mean, isn't it still true? Because you had to learn the language, you were working as a reporter, trying to be as objective as possible, despite the fact that you were part of the society and culture. You were in a different kind of situation for most people.
I was, and not only socially but also professionally, because professionally, having lived there so long, my wife's Israeli, my three boys were born there. So obviously, I looked at Israel differently than the correspondent, say, from the Washington Post, who comes for 3 years and goes, obviously. And yet I wasn't, I always felt that socially, I didn't have the position of a real Israeli because, I didn't do the army, I didn't have those contacts. And Israel is very much a country of contacts, but then most countries are.
You went to Tel Aviv, which is very different from the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Because it's on the coast?
Oh, I love the beach. Sunshine and a beach, can't beat
that. You walking the beach most of this way?
Most of the time, yeah, sure. Most of the time I was on the beach or sometimes along the cliff, but I kept very much to the coast, yeah.
And is Tel Aviv very different from everywhere else?
It's very different, I think it is. Well, the coast is very different. There are places in Haifa, Ashkelon. In fact, the coast...
But you went to Ashkelon as well.
I went everywhere along the coast, but Tel Aviv is actually, you know, I think it was National Geographic that recently said Tel Aviv, they put Tel Aviv in the list of the 10 most, the best beach cities in the world. So to include Tel Aviv in Israel as one of that on that list is pretty extraordinary. It's a great place to visit.
Who's living there now? Have many of the Russian emigres come to Tel Aviv?
Well, it's very expensive in the center of Tel Aviv, so not many of them do. But what happens is that when the immigrants come to Israel, they normally get assigned to what they call the development towns in the north and the south. And then they sort of slowly, as they get money and jobs, they come into the center. And so Tel Aviv now pretty much is everybody there.
And we talked about outsiders seeing Israel as a dangerous place. Can a place like Tel Aviv or Ashkelon be a dangerous place?
Absolutely, of course. I mean, during the bombing campaigns in the mid-90s and then in the 2000s, there were suicide bombs in Tel Aviv, probably as many as in Jerusalem, if not more. And Ashkelon is within rocket range of Gaza. So these are certainly, but in the book, I didn't underplay any of this. I was just pointing out it's not only about the violence.
Wait, tell me a bit about the city of Ashkelon. You spent a lot of time at Rogers Cafe.
Well, I did. You know, when I did the walk through Ashkelon, I found it boring and dreary place. And I actually walked straight through. One night was enough. I thought, well, I'm never going to come to Ashkelon again. And then 6 months later, the war began with Hamas in Gaza, and Hamas was shelling Ashkelon. So I found myself there for about 3 weeks, and I went to this place, Rogers Cafe. And I really actually fell in love with Ashkelon because it's such a surprising place, because so many of the Jews living there are Jews from Arab countries who have a completely different perspective, of course, than Jews from Europe.
The Mizrahim.
The Mizrahim, exactly.
And why did they have a different view? Because they lived as a minority in these Arab countries?
Yeah, these Jews, they came from, you know, Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria, Iraq, Syria. And they all say the same thing. They say, you know, we know the Arabs. If we sat down at a table with the Arabs, we'd make peace in 5 minutes. But meanwhile, they say, if there's a war, what their phrase was, in war as in war. Meanwhile, we're not sitting down. There's a war. We better win the war.
You ended at the border with Gaza. Is there a very different feeling down there?
It's pretty spooky, as a matter of fact.
Well, but you started in Lebanon, and Hezbollah has become more and more militant in recent times. And then you go to Gaza, again, an area where there's a lot of militancy.
Yeah, well, there's militancy on both sides, definitely, obviously. But in the north, you know, there's a Rosh Hanikra at the border. It's a much more organized border post with the UN crossing all the time. But in Gaza, the Israeli border kind of peters out along the beach, so you're not really sure where you are. And at one point, in fact, my journey stopped when the Israeli soldiers came and stopped me.
We have very little time, but I do want to know about all the different people you spoke to. Did you find any commonality between them and how they saw the country's future?
No.
Were they generally hopeful?
No. One thing you won't find is hopeful communality in Israel. You'll find a lot of pessimistic pragmatism.
Really? I mean,
I'm being a bit facetious.
Because people have survived in this tense atmosphere for a long time. There are people, outsiders, who think that Israel really would never really want peace because the Israelis have learned to live in this tense situation.
Yes, and I think a lot of criticism was directed against people who said that. However, I think it's quite true. I mean, the fact is that Israel's economy is strong. It's a vibrant place to live. You don't have the sense that day by day people are concerned with will the peace talks work. You know, they're getting on with their lives. Palestinians, on the other hand, of course, have a completely different perspective on that.
Martin Fletcher's book, Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation, is published by St. Martin's Press. It's been a great pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And I as well. The Pentagon bought tens of thousands of copies of the new book Operation Darkheart in order to destroy them on national security grounds. On tomorrow's show, the book's author, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, explains why they did it and what he witnessed in the war in Afghanistan. Then Jet Williams, Hank Williams' daughter, on a new collection of the country music pioneer's recordings. Also, Joseph O'Neill, author of the acclaimed novel Netherland, talks about his grandfathers, one Turkish, one Irish, who were both imprisoned for suspected subversion during World War II, plus award-winning historian Ron Chernow on the life of George Washington. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Carrie Barber, Jessica Ramey, Andrew Katchen, and Adi Braun. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great holiday today, and we'll see you tomorrow.